Yeah, so thanks very much for giving me the opportunity to speak today. I'm Ersin Nazir. I'm a junior research fellow at Imperial College London, and I thought I'd tell you a bit about work I've been doing over the past few years, really, on distributed exotonic dynamics in a few different systems, and trying to derive a kind of consistent but efficient treatment from weak to strong environmental coupling in these kind of systems. And if I have time, I might try and tell you a little bit about some future directions as well. So, to give a bit of context, I thought I'd start by just outlining a very basic theorist view of semiconductor quantum dots. So, semiconductor quantum dots are nanoscale islands of a narrow band gap material that are embedded in a surrounding wider band gap material. So, for example, here we have indium arsenide islands within gallium arsenide, and this not particularly easy to see figure is supposed to show a stack of two different dots here. They have a roughly dome-like shape. The three-dimensional confinement in these systems leads to atomic-like carrier states of discrete energy levels. And actually, for our purpose, I'm just going to consider a dot as a two-level system. And that actually is a fairly good description in many experimental situations as well. But the important point is that it's a two-level system which is strongly influenced, or can be strongly influenced, by the surrounding solid-state environment. And for the purposes of this talk, the environment will be phonons, so lattice vibrations. And then the kind of questions you might ask is, for example, how must we modify standard quantum optics treatments to account for the solid-state nature of the system? So, for example, what's the influence of phonons in the damping of Rabi oscillations or on the resonance fluorescence spectrum from these kinds of systems? Please ask questions at any point, by the way. So what's the two-level system here? Well, excitons are electron-hole pair states, and they're formed under excitation of an electron from the valence to the conduction band. And so our two-level system here in the strong confinement limit is the absence, which defines our zero of our qubit, say, and then the presence, x, of an exciton, and that defines our basis, our two-level system. And coherent manipulations of this two-level system are possible through external laser addressing. So we shine in with an external classical laser field, and we can drive Rabi oscillations of this two-level system. And the Rabi frequency, which is a measure of the quantum dot laser coupling, sets the time scale of those population oscillations. So schematically here, I mean, we see the two-level system driven here, and we see some kind of oscillations in time that will be damped by interactions with the surrounding. So actually, some motivation for looking at these systems. I guess I was already studying quantum dots, but I became interested in studying in more detail the phonon-induced damping of these kind of systems because of some experimental data which was obtained in Sheffield from the group of Morris Skolnick. So there they were looking at single indium gallium arsenide quantum dots that now were resonantly driven by a single laser pulse of Gaussian envelope. So a schematic of the experimental setup is shown here, but the kind of important part to look at is here. So this is our two-level system, our quantum dot, essentially. It's within a photodiode structure. So when an excitonic state is created, the electron and hole pair can tunnel out of this photodiode structure and give rise to a photocurrent. And that then gives us a detection of the exciton. So here, Rabi rotations in this experiment were measured as a function of pulse area, but with the pulse duration fixed. So rather than looking at damping as a function of time, the duration is always fixed, but how strongly we're driving the two-level system is varied. And then we see oscillations instead as a function of pulse area. So the important point was that these oscillations were seen to be damped, of course, but they were damped in a way that was dependent on how strongly you were driving the system. So if we just had some, say, fixed kind of phenomenological damping that just acted over the time scale of the pulse, we'd see some constant level of damping, which would give us these dotted oscillations here. But actually, that's not what's seen as the pulse area is increased. The damping increases as well. And in fact, they could fit the damping to a Rabi frequency squared dependence of the rho. So then the question that arises is, how can we account for this kind of damping? And is it a consequence of exciton-phonon interaction? Well, actually, the way that we go about modeling this system is fairly straightforward. We try and derive a master equation that will account for the phonon influence on the excitonic dynamics. So we start with a Hamiltonian. It's written in a rotating frame of the laser. So this is the detuning of the laser from the excitonic state. This is a term driving Rabi oscillations of our two-level system. Then we have a backup harmonic oscillators representing the phonon environment, and then coupling between the excitonic state and displacements of that phonon environment. So generally, for deriving a master equation, we'll write our Hamiltonian as the sum of two parts, which is so an H0 to which a solution is known to all orders, so it's something very straightforward, and then HI, which we'll treat as a small perturbation. And here, of course, we're going to treat this as our H0, the uncoupled part of the Hamiltonian, and treat the exciton-phonon interaction as a perturbation. Then we perform the kind of standard master equation derivation, so we derive a second-order master equation in HI that describes now just the excitonic degrees of freedom, so that's just the two-level system degrees of freedom, but under the influence of the phonon environment. So this gives us a reduced description that's intuitive, efficient, and generally relatively straightforward to work with. An important definition here is the spectral density, and that gives us a measure of the exciton-phonon coupling, but it's weighted by the phonon density of states at a particular frequency. And generally, I mean, here it has a fairly simple form, so it increases with some power law at low frequencies, and then there's some cutoff at higher frequency that means it reduces back down to zero at high enough frequency. The important thing to say about this spectral density is we're going to see that actually the rate of damping that comes out of this theory is proportional to the spectral density evaluated at the Rabi frequency, so evaluated at the frequency with which we're driving the system and at which the dress states of the system are split. And so that means that as we scan the Rabi frequency, we're scanning along the spectral density here, and we can see that our rate should change with the Rabi frequency as well, naturally, because of that. One of the definitions for later in the talk is the reorganization energy, and that can just be taken as a measure of the system-environment coupling. So let's have a look at the experiment theory comparison then. Well, on resonance, we can actually derive a very simple or approximate master equation that has a driving frequency-dependent rate, as I said. So here we have a density operator representing our quantum dots. The first term just drives coherence oscillations of the two-level system as we would have in the absence of the environment. And then we have some damping that actually looks like pure dephasing in this situation. But importantly, the rate is proportional to a temperature-dependent factor and also the spectral density evaluated at the Rabi frequency. Now, because the dominant coupling is expected to be to acoustic phonons in these systems, we can actually show that they have a spectral density that varies as the cube of the frequency at low frequencies. So if we expand this within a high temperature regime, we find precisely our Rabi frequency squared type damping, which is what we wanted. And also we can plot out the temperature dependence of this free factor, and we find that it lies within the range expected for gallium arsenide, both material parameters. And we can also, fit the theory across a range of temperatures and pulse areas and find very good agreement across the full temperature range.
So if I understand correctly here, you derived this expression for gamma, but you're not showing us the details.
I haven't gone through all the details, but it's a standard weak coupling master equation treatment. So it's essentially like a Redfield master equation, but I've made some further approximations just because of the regime that I'm interested in here.
Yeah, but you first dressed the system with the field, and then you did the master equation.
So the driving is taken into account non-perturbatively, yeah. Okay, so that was kind of very sort of quick motivation along the lines of quantum dot systems, just because they're systems that I've been interested in for quite some time. But actually what I'm interested in talking about today more is going beyond that kind of weak coupling theory and how we can derive theories that can account for strong coupling to the environments as well, but still maintain this master equation type formalism, so we have a fairly efficient and intuitive way of looking at the system. So one thing we can say is that weak coupling theory captures only single phonon processes, so that could well be a problem as the temperature or the system back coupling is increased. And in fact, because I didn't make a secular approximation in the previous derivation, so I didn't put it in Lindblad form, that means that the equation can even become physical in some regimes, and we can see that here. So I'm again plotting out, just look at the red dashed lines for the moment. I'm again plotting out the weak coupling theory as a function of pulse area. So this is the population of the dot excited state. And as I change to higher temperatures above the experimental temperatures, I find that at some point the weak coupling theory can actually go unphysical, and so obviously that's a big problem. And it could be, I could fix that by making kind of standard approximations that would put it in Lindblad form, but I would find that I still wouldn't be properly capturing what you would expect in that regime, because the second order approximation is breaking down. However, we can't derive a second order master equation that's valid beyond these limitations by applying a Polaron transformation, and that's shown in blue here. We can see that remains physical even at these higher temperatures. And the details of this are now coming up in the next part. So more generally, some motivation for looking at this kind of theory is to actually optimize the perturbative approach itself. So if we assume a system bath description, then master equation techniques are a useful tool with which to analyze these systems. And I've said this before, it's because we work with a reduced description in terms of the system degrees of freedom only, and so they're intuitive and efficient and generally relatively straightforward to work with. However, practical master equation nearly always requires some kind of approximation. So as before, I said there's some H0 to which we know the solution is treated to all orders. So that was the driving and the uncoupled bath before. And then some HI that we treat as a perturbation, and that was literally the system bath interaction previously. So often master equations are valid only in rather restrictive parameter regimes. And of course, we would like to explore the dynamics over as wide a range of parameters as possible, given the limitations of the theory. So then the question that we can ask is, with some kind of vague notion of best, what is the best we can do with a perturbative second-order master equation? So how can we engineer the interaction term within the Hamiltonian so it remains small over a large regime of parameters? So we're not going to take the literal interaction terms within the Hamiltonian as the perturbation anymore. We're going to apply unitary transformations to the Hamiltonian to try and get a new representation that already takes into account of some of the strong coupling physics at the Hamiltonian level. So I got interested in some other systems as well, just to say that I became interested in energy transfer actually originally because Brian Gerardot, who's in Heriot Watt in Edinburgh, was looking at energy transfer between closely spaced pairs of quantum dots and trying to understand under what conditions he might expect to see coherent or incoherent transfer in such a system. And so I started to work on then a consistent treatment that might be able to look at both those regimes. And then I became aware of experiments in a number of other systems, such as conjugated polymers and light harvesting complexes, where similar questions were being asked in terms of whether coherence was present or not, and also what its role would be, and how we might model these kind of systems that were expected to be strongly coupled to their environments and also at relatively high temperatures as well. So just to say that if we're looking at a pair of two-level systems that are coupled to each other, we can actually map that onto the spin boson model that I was looking at before, which was essentially just a single two-level system being externally driven. So here we have what I'm calling a donor-acceptor pair, so a pair of two-level systems with a single excitation within there. And there's some interaction that can transfer energy between the two, and they're also within some environment. So the Hamiltonian for that is given here with their splitting of each system, the coupling that transfers excitation, and the harmonic oscillator bath that couples to each of the two-level systems. Now, if we've got a separation of timescales in this system, such that excitation is lost on a much longer timescale than the initial damped, though perhaps coherent, dynamics is occurring, then we can work just in a single excitation subspace. And so we map the single excitation states now onto a two-level system that looks like our quantum dot two-level system from before. But now these are the single excitation states, and the electronic coupling strength V now plays the role of what was the Rabi frequency in the previous case. And so the Hamiltonian is essentially the same before, and it has this spin boson type form. It's just written in a slightly different way here. But the important point is that the techniques that I'll apply now in the next section can be equally well thought of as applying to this energy transfer problem as to the original driven dot. So let's have a look at that spin boson model and talk about some exactly solvable limits, try and analyze what's going on. Well, trivially, if the system back coupling is zero, then we just have undamped oscillations at a generalized Rabi frequency given by this expression. So, okay, that's fine. But there's also another exactly solvable limit, and that's if the electronic coupling V goes to zero. In this case, we can then write the Hamiltonian explicitly in this form, where we have displaced oscillators associated with each of the two-level system basis states. And in fact, if the electronic coupling is zero, if we were to apply an excitation state dependent displacement, which is a polaron transformation, to the original Hamiltonian, we would remove the linear coupling term in that Hamiltonian. So the displacement is given here. So we apply these unitary displacement operators to the Hamiltonian, where the displacement is dependent on the state of the two-level system as well. So the polaron transformation will diagonalize our Hamiltonian if the electronic coupling is zero. So there are two common approximations around this, these two exactly solvable limits. The first is the Redfield approximation, and that's precisely what I used in the first part of the talk. So you take the interaction term to be literally the exciton phonon coupling in that situation, and you treat that to second order. And then, so the Redfield master equation, as I've said, it captures only single phonon processes, So it's valid only really at weak system back coupling or small reorganization energy in these terms. So what I'm showing here is that for small reorganization energy, the green here, we have exponentially damped oscillations, as we might expect. And then as we increase the reorganization energy, so the system back coupling strength, they become more strongly damped, until eventually all the curves seem not to oscillate anymore, but they all lie on top of each other as well. And this is known to be the incorrect behavior. The rate should not plateau in that way. And we can actually get the correct behavior in that regime by perturbing around the other limit. So now we take the electronic coupling to be the perturbation and treat everything else in the Hamiltonian as our H0. And then we get what's known as Foerster theory. So Foerster theory actually captures only incoherent processes. So we see that at weak coupling, the green curve here, we just get a kind of exponential decay. So we have no oscillations at all. And that is not the correct behavior in that regime. But as we move to larger reorganization energies, so stronger system back coupling, we see that our rate now starts to decrease at strong system back coupling. And that's the behavior that the Redfield equation can't capture. So really, we would like something that could interpolate between these two regimes and encapsulate both within a single theory. So let's go back to the polaron transformation again then, but we'll apply it to our full Hamiltonian and have a look what we can do in that situation. So if we do that, we find that the bias term here is unchanged, but we can extract a renormalized electronic coupling strength, so that's VR here. And that renormalized coupling strength is dependent both on the temperature and on the spectral density under consideration. And now our interaction term has changed, so we're coupling transitions in the two-level system to displacements, multimode displacements of the bath, rather than the linearly coupling as we were in the previous Hamiltonian. So now if we take this HI as our interaction Hamiltonian and perform the standard second order, essentially Redfield type, but it's no longer weak coupling, master equation, we can derive a theory that will interpolate between the weak coupling and the first order limits. And actually, I've just plotted out here the kind of rate that was damping the oscillations before, and we see the weak coupling rate sort of plateauing here. The first array is completely wrong at small temperature here, but becomes correct at higher temperature, and then the full rate interpolates between those two limits. So if we go back to the driven quantum dot that I showed before, now that's exactly how these blue curves were derived. So I performed a Polaron transformation on the original Hamiltonian, and then a second order master equation to get that dynamics. What time have I gotten? So I can't remember what time I started.
Well, so the whole thing should finish it by 12.
Okay,
so,
fine.
So if you went, you know, another 10 minutes, it
would be
fine. That's
some
questions.
Oh. All right, so the Polaron transformation all looks pretty good then. But actually, it has some quite serious limitations. So I mentioned the spectral density at all before. I mentioned the spectral density. And actually, it doesn't work at all, really, for ohmic environments, or at least not in the kind of formalism I'm presenting. So when I say ohmic environments here, I mean an environment that varies linearly with the frequency. So what I was considering before in terms of quantum dots were superohmic environments. And in that situation, it worked well. But here, there's an infrared divergence in the renormalized coupling strength, which leads, in the exponent of the renormalized coupling strength, which leads to the renormalized coupling strength going to zero, and that's because the power of the frequency and the spectral density is not large enough here to allow that to converge. And so now our Polaron transformed Hamiltonian no longer has any electronic coupling in the system part at a renormalized strength or otherwise, and so the master equation will no longer capture coherent energy transfer dynamics, and it essentially just reduces back to first order theory in that case. So for an ohmic environment or a sub-ohmic environment, we don't really gain by performing the Polaron transformation, or we only gain in the strong coupling regime, but we lose the weak coupling limit. Actually, even for the superohmic environment, in which it works quite well, if the electronic coupling becomes large in comparison to the important frequencies in the environmental spectral density, then the theory predicts too much damping, even in that case. And both of these problems are related to the same physics. We're assuming that we want to displace the modes of the environment fully in the Polaron transformation, but actually, low-frequency modes are sluggish, and they can't follow the motion of the two-level system and be fully displaced with them. So the theory is fine for the high-frequency modes, and when they dominate, we're all okay. But when low-frequency modes are important, we run into problems. So how do we go beyond that kind of situation? Well, let's again apply our excitation state-dependent displacement transformation, so a Polaron-like transformation. But we'll allow now the magnitudes to be tunable. So these FKs here are variational parameters, and they're defined for each mode K of the harmonic oscillator path. So in this situation, if FK were zero, we'd have no transformation, and we just have weak coupling theory. And if FK goes to the coupling strength GK, then we have the Polaron transformation, and we're back in that regime. But in general, we might have a transformed Hamiltonian that contains both weak coupling and Polaron type terms. And so what we do now is we optimize this transformation by minimizing an upper bound on the system free energy. And that's following the seminal work of Silvey and Harris, who are looking particularly at ground states of these kinds of systems with these kinds of transformations. And that gives us actually a self-consistent equation that I haven't written down in detail for the variationally optimized displacements that depends on the various Hamiltonian parameters. But the important point is that when the electronic coupling strength over the environmental oscillator frequency is small, we regain full displacement as we might expect. So those oscillators that are high frequency will follow the two-level system and displace. But when we're in the opposite regime and the ratio is large, the FK goes to zero and we get no displacement. And so that tells us for the sluggish oscillators, we don't displace anymore. And that's going to get rid of our infrared divergences and other problems associated with those kind of oscillators. So let's apply just the machinery of the second order master equation, time local master equation, in this variational representation. And now for an ohmic bath, where I said before the full polaron transformation would just give us back this first type behavior. But you can see that the variational theory now seems to do a good job of taking us consistently from the red field limit to this first limit. So we see damped coherent oscillations at small reorganization energies. They get more and more damped, but then at large reorganization energy, we get the same incoherent behavior as we would expect in the first limit. So we get a theory that can interpolate correctly between those two. Actually, if we go back to the superohmic case, so these are actually plots for a different quantum dot where the Rabi frequency, or equivalently for the energy transfer case, the electronic coupling strength is increasing. What I'm showing here is, so this is a regime where sluggish oscillators are not important, and so the green points here are in numerically exact path integral calculations, and the blue and grey lines that you can't distinguish from each other are polaron and variational theories, and the red dashed line is a weak coupling theory that doesn't work here because we're in a quite high temperature regime. We can see as we increase the electronic coupling strength or the Rabi frequency, the weak coupling theory still doesn't agree, but the polaron theory starts to deviate because these sluggish oscillators are becoming important. The variational theory can still capture that well, and even in this extreme regime where the electronic coupling strength is now becoming large compared to the cutoff frequency in the environment, you can see that here weak coupling theory is actually now becoming a fairly good approximation, but the polaron theory damps too much, as I said, and the variational theory can still perform well in comparison to the numerics. So actually, for superohmic back here, there's good quantitative agreement with the path integral numerics as well. So I won't go through this in much detail, but I'll just say that we've generalized. So I mentioned that I was interested as well in energy transfer systems, so we've generalized this variational theory to multi-site systems now. So that's fairly straightforward to generalize. We just write down what the expected generalization to n sites would be in terms of the displacement transformation, and then we have to do an optimization again by minimizing the upper bound on the system free energy. That there could be a number of actually interesting techniques with which to improve that optimization. We've just done it in a very basic way so far, and then we derive again a time local master equation, so it becomes at that point essentially as easy to apply as red field theory. And some example results. So this is for a complex known as FMO, and a seven-site version of FMO. And we have this ohmic-type spectrum with a Drude-Lorentz cutoff. And there are actually some numerically exact plots for this system derived with a hierarchy of master equations approach, which works very well at high temperatures for this kind of spectral density. And we can see, at least by eye, that the variational theory seems to do a pretty good job of capturing the main features of the dynamics in the numerically exact calculations as well.
Or is this with the ohmic spectral density now?
This is ohmic, yeah.
So it does work with the ohmic spectral density for the variational?
The variational does, yeah. Sorry, I probably skipped through that too quickly.
Which is the exact?
So this is the numerically exact taken from Ishizaki and Fleming's paper. And this is the variational theory generalized to multiple sites. Actually, I wanted to briefly mention stuff that I'm doing now. I'm going beyond this variational type approach. So, actually, although it seems to work quite well in a number of situations, there's always going to be regimes where this kind of description breaks down. So there's two major approximations, I suppose. One, that displacement associated with each of the two-level system states is a good way to represent the Hamiltonian in the first place. And then their variational optimization of those displacements. And then the other major approximation is a second-order master equation approximation. Now, if we stick with the second-order master equation, then we might start to ask questions about, is just a single type of displacement of the modes a good way to represent what's going on in the system? And actually, you can see in a number of situations that this might not be the case. So what I'm showing here is we'll just think about a single oscillator in the environment for the moment. So here's two wells displaced according to the spin state of the two-level system. So we've just got a spin boson model again of this form. Now, what the Silby-Harris theory tells you to do is, instead of displacing the oscillators fully for these shallow-type potentials that are sluggish, it says leave them closer to the origin. So suppress their displacements, and in the extreme limit, don't displace them at all. But what about if we consider non-adiabatic transitions straight up at an unrenormalized tunneling strength instead? Are there situations where the reorganization energy is such that they become favorable? Well, in fact, for a single mode, I'm showing here precisely such a case. So for a single mode environment, obviously we can just do a direct numerical diagonalization. So these are real space oscillator wave functions as a function of displacement. We're in a regime here where the coupling compared to the oscillator frequency is strong, and also the tunneling element is strong. So it's favorable to retain tunneling energy within the Hamiltonian in the variational method. The dotted line here is Silby-Harris type minimization, so single displacement. So I should say this is our ground state ansatz here. If these P's were zero, we would have just single displacements associated with each of the two-level system states. And when these P's are non-zero, we now have a superposition of displacements associated. And what we can actually see is that Silby-Harris-type displacement completely fails to capture the oscillator wave function here. But if we allow this extra freedom, what we're calling a kind of antipolaron displacement, then we see that clear signatures in the exact diagonalization of that behavior. So here, this is the polaronic component of each of the two states that correspond to each of the two spin states. And this is the antipolaronic component. And our ansatz are the solid lines that you might just be able to see, and the circles are the numerical diagonalization. So there's a situation for a single mode, at least, in which Silby-Harris type displacement breaks down, but we can still capture it with a more general variational state. And in fact, we have applied this to the multi-mode VAT as well, and we find that it performs much better in comparison to something like numerical renormalization group calculation. So here's ground state coherence at zero temperature from this Hamiltonian. The NRG is the dashed line with solid circles. Silby-Harris, eventually at large coupling, completely suppresses the coherence in the system. It completely kills the tunneling, and that gets renormalized to zero. But with our more flexible ansatz that has coherent state superposition within it, then we find that the tunneling is not completely killed at large coupling strength, and we get a much better agreement with the NRG calculations. Okay, last thing. What about going beyond Sylvie Harris in terms of dynamics? Because it's quite hard to say how you might turn that coherent state superposition into some sort of unitary transformation that we could apply in our second order master equation. Well, we can also perform mappings at the Hamiltonian level to different representations. And so here, this slightly ropey diagram is supposed to show our two-level system coupled to independent oscillators that we can actually map to a two-level system coupled to an effective single-mode oscillator that itself is damped by coupling to independent oscillators. And now we treat the two-level system and the single oscillator as our system, and we trace out the rest of the bath in a standard second-order approximation. So we're keeping the full kind of quantum mechanical correlations within this part. And again, I'm showing some comparisons here between work of Ishizaki and Fleming. So this is on a two-sided system. They're increasing the system bath coupling strength here. Again, these are hierarchical type equations that are numerically exact. And you see that as they increase the coupling strength, the Redfield equation starts to perform very badly, as we might expect. And in fact, in this regime of parameters, the variational theory is marginally better than the Redfield theory, but can't really capture these highly non-Markovian dynamics at short times here that give rise to these pronounced oscillations. But we see that when we perform this reaction coordinate mapping, we actually capture the trends